You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I am always and forever here in my individual capacity, and we're continuing our series on our rising energy needs, which have developed into a significant national security concern. We're going to go back in our series now to talk about something we raised very early on in our discussions with two nuclear scientists, and that is changes in legislation. And in particular, you can see some massive shifts in two pieces of legislation. One is the One Big Beautiful Bill. And of course, each year, you also notice these things in the National Defense Authorization Act, which throughout this podcast, we would refer to as the NDAA. And to help us with this, my guest tonight is Tyler O'Connor. Tyler O'Connor is an energy litigator and public policy leader at Crowell & Moring's Washington, D.C. office, where he represents clients in courts. And of course, before the Federal Energy Regulation Commission, which we're going to call FERC, as well as the Department of Energy and on Capitol Hill. And his recent work includes advising companies on energy policy reforms. And he testified before Congress earlier this year on that subject. And before joining Crowell, Tyler served as energy counsel to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, in which role he worked on both the Inflation Reduction Act and Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And because of that work, Washingtonian Magazine named Tyler one of the 500 most influential people shaping policy in Washington, D.C. in 2023. Tyler, thanks for coming in. Glad to have you.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I'm a little bit disheartened to hear that your previous podcast guests were nuclear scientists. I couldn't meet that high bar, and I also couldn't become a doctor, so I settled for lawyer. But I appreciate you having me here nonetheless.
Yeah, it can be a collection of people who really couldn't do math. Actually, listening to this podcast, we have a large number of people who are both scientists and lawyers. But, you know, we just invite smart, conversant people anyway who understand the issues, and you very clearly do. Let's give our listeners a big picture first. Let's talk about where we were, say, 3 years ago, and then how things have shifted in terms of Congress and the executive and the way they're approaching energy. And in the course of talking about this, let's try to talk about what prompted this shift other than politics.
I think at bottom, the zeitgeist has changed. President Biden and congressional Democrats were really focused on investing in and deploying carbon-free resources. Their lodestar in making any investment decision was whether it would reduce carbon emissions, provide good-paying union jobs, and benefit the communities in which those projects were located. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act, which you referenced earlier, also included significant investments and incentives to reshore domestic manufacturing, with a particular focus on discouraging investments in kind of Chinese-owned supply chains. And then in addition to relying, of course, extensively on incentives like tax credits, grants, and loans, they also proposed and adopted a number of regulatory reforms intended to limit the deployment of more polluting emitting resources. I think it's safe to say the Trump administration has a different perspective and has taken a different approach. They are unabashedly disinterested in addressing climate change, as evidenced originally by the president withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord on his first day in office, but also by action since then. And in fact, I think he appears disinterested in deploying renewable resources at all. Instead, his administration seems focused on kind of one primary goal or overarching trend, which is addressing load growth from data centers and artificial intelligence, as well as some more advanced manufacturing. If you were to ask this administration, they would say, we need to bring more energy online to meet growing demand, but that energy should be only or at least primarily from thermal resources, from coal, from natural gas, from nuclear. And I think we've seen that in the course of recent legislation.
Okay. It's always awkward for me to take the counterpoint on some of these things, but I think one of the things that I learned from some of the scientists that we had on here sort of challenged my belief system a bit in terms of how much we can actually operate some of these AI systems, how much we can operate defense weapons based solely on renewables, right? And how that interface between all of them is great, But that at the end of the day, with the expanding need for these data centers and the development of AI, and inevitably, I would say, Tyler, probably quantum, that there's just no interest in that from the business community because there's no deliverable. There's nothing they can tell anybody on earnings calls, one. And two, we're just not that far along with our development of green energy, and this has to be done right now and maybe yesterday, right?
Yeah, I think there's a few things to parse there. One of them is the speed to deployment. And I don't disagree, first of all, with prior podcasters, if their position is that you need a diverse mix of resources. There's been a phrase for a long time in Washington, D.C. in political circles. We've certainly heard it on campaigns about an all-of-the-above energy strategy. I think what's been interesting about the Trump administration strategy is that they have largely abandoned the all-of-the-above approach. What they've said is certain resources are better than others, and they intend to prioritize those resources at the expense of renewable resources. And so I think the question is, what are you optimizing for? If you're looking for speed to interconnection, how quickly can we get resources on the grid? There is no question that renewables, and in particular solar, can get interconnected to the grid as quickly as any, if not much more quickly than any other resource. And you only have to look at the most recent attempts to build new nuclear power plants to know that solar can come online much more quickly than a nuclear plant, with, I think, several notable exceptions, which are those repowering or restarting of previously shuttered, recently shuttered nuclear power plants. So I think if we're looking for time to market, you want to bring on as many renewable resources to meet short-term needs as possible. But there's also the question of cost, where I think renewables perform favorably to kind of more thermal resources. And then, of course, externalities. Now, all that being said, I completely grant your premise, and I'm not on this podcast to say we should have a grid running 100% on renewable resources. I think the laws of physics, at least at this point in time, would make that impossible. So, you know, all I'm intending to say is that the Biden administration, I think, prioritized resources that were zero carbon emitting, and the Trump administration has removed that criteria as either a gating criteria or a relevant factor. And I think that's been evidenced both by this recent One Big Beautiful Bill and the tax policy changes they've made there, as well as some of the actions that the administration has taken at the agency level, and which I'm sure we'll discuss on this call.
I see. So there was a massive seismic shift. I think where the bridge is between the two administrations, and you mentioned it, is the fact that there's been one approach to supply chain, which was sort of sanctions, trying to onshore things in the last administration. And then this administration has said that they're doing it in almost a, I don't want to say a violent way, but a more forceful way. They want to bring manufacturing back. But at the end of the day, I think whether you're a Democrat or Republican, we've all learned, maybe COVID was a good lesson, that supply chain issues are a significant problem in the United States, period. Not just with healthcare, but also with respect to energy, when, you know, China's got 85% of the copper refining capability and we have none. And we're all depending on these things for the renewables, like the minerals that we need in order to have our solar panels or my fancy electric car that I like to drive. And at the end of the day, we don't have these things here. And we've ceded all control of those things really to the Chinese at this point. I mean, if you want to talk about who's got the lion's share of this stuff. And I think both administrations have recognized that. It's how they went about it that seems to me to be drastically different. And only in the fullness of time will we see how well this works.
I think that's right. I think both of them are focused in their own ways about reshoring domestic supply chains. Although I think the parts of the supply chain they want to focus on and the tools they are using are very different. One of the things we've seen over the last few years of the Biden administration is the emergence of what people have called a battery belt in the Southeast. As we brought back a lot of manufacturing and domestic production of EV batteries to the United States that used to be done abroad and were particularly reliant on China. You know, the Section 45X Advanced Manufacturing Production Tax Credit, which passed as part of the IRA, created a tax credit that incentivized the production of certain energy components, among them battery storage components, solar components, which were made primarily in China, and which continue to be made primarily by Chinese companies. But we have seen, as a result of that tax credit, some reshoring to the United States. And it also created a tax incentive for the production of critical minerals in the United States. That was in the Inflation Reduction Act. I think what we see now is instead of this incentives-based approach, we're seeing a little bit more of a, what I would, instead of a carrot, more of a stick, right? The imposition of tariffs in the hope that by driving up the cost of certain inputs, imported inputs, that folks would make the economic decision to reshore certain of that manufacturing to the United States. I think time will tell, but I think what we're seeing in most recent CPI reports is that there may be some increased costs for goods coming into the United States. And it will be interesting to see whether that incents companies to build more projects in the United States or whether raising the cost of their inputs actually disincentivizes it. And that's something that I think, you know, as a lawyer who works on a lot of projects, I'm very keenly interested to see how that will manifest.
Yeah. And I think, Tyler, to your point, I think one of the things that I'd be concerned about, regardless of which party I was in or which administration I was serving, it's just the plain fact that it takes a lot of time to build these things. Like to bring a nuclear power plant online takes a very long time. And it also takes, you know, enriched uranium, which apparently we get from Russia and Canada. In our world, it's about quarterly filings. You got to explain yourself on those earnings calls. It's all about ROI. And it seems like the way things are set up now, and I'm not evaluating it in a moral way, but as a fact way, which is it's designed to meet those quarterly needs, that earnings call, the ROI. It feels like it's all more directed at that right now. It seems like there are many of these projects, there's never going to be any ROI in a reasonable time frame, like a nuclear power plant. And at some point, there's going to have to be government investment. And this is what I'm hearing from the scientists and the people with the business mind, that there's going to have to be massive government investment, which is going to take us to this legislative discussion that we're going to have today. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that kind of promised government investment in any of these bills. But do you mind if we go ahead and pivot and we start talking about the one big, beautiful bill? It's got a corny name, but let's talk about how this seismic shift in sort of approach to what I think we've just said uniformly across America, regardless of party, we all understand that we need to have greater control over the energy and supply chain issues, including critical minerals and fossil fuels. What do we see in this bill that looks like it's trying to shift this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we see in this bill was an attempt to do addition by subtraction. And what I mean by that is you will find some, but not many new investments in energy supply chains. You will not find many investments to deploy additional energy resources. And you won't find many investments to incent new energy-specific manufacturing. What it primarily does is eliminate tax credits, grants, and loans that were included in the Inflation Reduction Act and which, you know, the president and congressional Republicans determined were inconsistent with their national energy priorities. So how does that manifest? We've seen the paring back, for instance, of the Section 45X Advanced Manufacturing Production Tax Credit for wind energy components. So that is now going to be phased out relatively quickly. We have seen the not immediate, but very quick phasing out of the Section 48E Clean Electricity Investment Tax Credit and the Section 45Y Clean Electricity Production Tax Credit, which were tax credits, respectively, for the investment and production of electricity from clean energy resources, not just renewables, but any zero carbon emitting resource. And across the board, we've seen, you know, the deletion, essentially, of different grants and loans that were intended to facilitate certain types of energy and primarily clean energy projects. There's a few things in here that are additive in terms of, you know, making new investments. There's a new tax credit for metallurgical coal, which is used in the steelmaking process. I guess there's also a reform to the Section 1706. It used to be the Energy Community Reinvestment Program. I may have botched that name, but they've repealed a significant amount of funding for programs run by the Department of Energy's Loan Programs Office, but then created a new program intended to finance projects that either increase the capacity or output of a particular project, or that support or enable investments in projects that enhance grid reliability or address resource adequacy. And so I think what's been done here, by and large, was an effort, right, to save money in order to make other investments in other parts of the tax code. when I think about how this reorganizes the energy system, it's not by making it more robust. It's by removing incentives that were otherwise available or would have been available for certain types of resources, which are now disfavored as a national policy matter. And another example is, you know, because you talked before about critical minerals, you know, I had mentioned that the Section 45X Advanced Manufacturing Production Tax Credit included a tax credit for critical minerals. And it's my understanding that whereas that provision was formerly permanent, this new OBBB now phases that tax credit out sometime in the 2030s.
All right. That sounds like it was a process of elimination. Is there anything in the bill that would promote the development of nuclear energy in this country? It may be a highly risky business, but it doesn't emit fossil fuels. Did you see anything in the legislation that addressed that?
Yeah. So there's a tax credit, a pre-existing tax credit, Section 45U, Zero Emission Nuclear Power Production Tax Credit. That was primarily retained in the bill, as was the tax credit, the Section 48E and Section 45Y, those clean electricity production tax credits. They are retained for nuclear energy. And then the bill adds a new energy community bonus credit for certain advanced nuclear facilities that are located in areas that formerly had a nuclear, you know, high nuclear power plant employment.
What we've heard a lot about how our grid is not that great, right? And apparently we came as close as one could a few years ago during that large Texas snowstorm to having a full grid collapse, at least in that region. What, if anything, was in there to address the fact of our aging, apparently not that scalable grid?
Yeah, I think this is one area where Congress could have and should have probably done more. They deleted grants, right? Defunded grant programs intended to facilitate the siting of certain transmission lines. But other than that, they really left the grid untouched. And so I think there are discussions, however, about what are the best ways to incent new transmission and what are the best ways to build a stronger, more resilient grid. And many of those things are not things that can be done easily through grants. So I think, you know, one thing we've seen in the aftermath of OBBB is some discussion, again, about permitting reform. And so we will see if whether Congress and the president elect to pursue permitting reform this Congress, and whether those reforms end up including reforms to our transmission permitting process in this country. But the OBBB itself does not make any material investments in transmission or building the grid. It arguably removes what few investments and inducements we already had.
All right. What about other energy infrastructure? And this is more probably like stuff that you've considered. And when I think of energy infrastructure, I think movement of energy from one place to another, storing of energy, development of energy creating projects. Is there anything in this bill that would improve or expand existing energy infrastructure short of the grid?
Yeah, you know, I think there are certain titles within the Energy and Commerce's Committee's jurisdiction and Senate Energy Committee's jurisdiction, which, you know, may make it easier to permit certain types of projects. But by and large, you know, the reconciliation process, you know, essentially requires you to either spend money or raise revenue. And so many of these thorny questions that we talk about in terms of whether it's transporting electricity, transporting natural gas, transporting LNG, many times these are things that the financial incentive to build them is already there. And the question is, what regulatory roadblocks or what regulatory barriers exist? And is there a way to make those barriers more surmountable? Well, I think, you know, the Energy and Commerce Committee and Senate Energy Committees both took a crack at addressing some of those issues. I think primarily a lot of these changes are going to have to be pursued through kind of some regular order, requires 60 votes on a motion to proceed in the Senate type of process. And so that's why I suggested that I think some of these issues, particularly around the transportation of energy, are probably better suited for a permitting package than the strictures of a reconciliation package. Well, one other thing I think is really important and has been getting a lot of attention are the new foreign entity restrictions that were included in OBBB. There have been discussions, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act as well as one provision, I believe, in the infrastructure bill and one provision in the CHIPS and Science Act, if I have that correctly, all barred certain funds or tax incentives, depending on the situation, for use by certain foreign entities of concern. You know, the way to think about that provision historically is that a foreign entity of concern is an entity that meets any one of several enumerated criteria. But basically, are you a Chinese-controlled company, a Russian-controlled company, et cetera? What this new tax bill does, the OBBB, is it imposes more burdensome, more onerous foreign entity restrictions, prohibiting tax credits for certain prohibited foreign entities, for certain specified foreign entities, and in some instances, from companies that receive material assistance, quote unquote, from such entities. And without going in, you know, too far into the particulars, really the idea is that we want to disincentivize or at least not provide incentives to companies that are either themselves entities of concern or which rely too heavily on those entities. I think the practical impact, however, and one that we're tracking closely, is whether these restrictions impose unduly burdensome barriers to the development and production of products in the United States. What we don't want to do is create a restriction that is either impossible or really, really difficult to meet, such that most companies are unable to achieve it. And why don't we want to do that? Because if you do, then you eliminate the incentive to try and meet that restriction. So put another way, if you create an attainable foreign entity of concern restriction such that you can achieve it, and if you achieve it, you get a tax credit, companies are more likely to try to comply with whatever restrictions occur. But if many companies, including all of their competitors, aren't able to meet those barriers or meet that heightened restriction, then I think they're less likely to make those incentives and move away from Chinese supply chains. So I do worry that in their admirable efforts to adopt new foreign entity of concern restrictions, Congress may have inadvertently undermined the incentives that many companies had to reshore to the United States and to move their supply chains away from China.
It also raises an issue that we talk about a lot on this podcast, which is how much does that duplicate the CFIUS process to the extent we're talking about foreign investment? So this is something slightly different, though, correct?
I will defer to you and your other podcast guests on the CFIUS process, which is not my area of expertise and not one I should be opining on, although admittedly, that doesn't always stop me. So the foreign entity of concern restrictions are really about who owns or controls or provides assistance to companies that are trying to avail themselves, that are trying to claim a tax credit.
Got it.
And so this isn't about can a Chinese company acquire a U.S. company and whether it poses a threat to national security, but it's really about is this company itself a Chinese company trying to claim a tax credit? Is it influenced? While it may itself not be a Chinese company, does it have such material ties to China or Russia that we consider it influenced by those countries? And then in some instances, do they receive material assistance? So are they purchasing certain components from entities that are tied to China in such a way that we think it's inconsistent with our national security objectives?
Yeah.
And so I think the processes of CFIUS and the tax credit, the FEOC restrictions are different, but I think, you know, they still fall comfortably under the umbrella of trying to ensure that companies that are availing themselves of the U.S. system are acting kind of consistent with our national security obligations.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.